It's only me, Vicky. Are you there? Oh, no, that's silly. Where else would you be? I'm coming down. Oh, oops. Careful. Sorry, I slipped. Honestly, one day those steps will be the death of me. Oh. There now. The sooner Carthage gets lifts and elevators, the better. Only a couple of thousand years to go. I did try to explain the basic principle to Troilus, but he didn't get it. You know what he's like, bless him. Heroic. This month he's supervising the building of an important new quinquereme, but he doesn't even understand a simple system of pulleys. That's what you get for marrying a Trojan prince. That's how heroes think. If it's not a mighty deed, it doesn't count. Anyway, that's not why I'm here. I've finished it. The first draft, anyway, but I'm not telling the scribe that. Not yet. He thinks it's all done, and he's gone to soak his hand in ass's milk or something. He was so grumpy. So I told him that if the scribes didn't hoard all the papyrus, I'd have written it myself. I mean, they've got a monopoly on the stuff. I told Troilus that someone should raise the subject in the council. Carthaginian scribes aren't the only ones who can write, you know. Are you listening? Sulking again. Well, never mind. I've brought this down here for you. I thought I could read it through and see what you thought. I'm just trying to remember. It was so long ago, but it's amazing how much came back once I'd sat down and thought about it. The scribe thinks I'm quite mad, of course. Lady Cressida, are you sure this is what you want me to write? But I'm paying, so he can't argue. And travelling with the doctor was so very special. I just don't want to forget. So, here we are. The first scroll. It seems so long ago, and so far away, in the future. At first I thought the TARDIS scanner had gone wrong again. All it was showing was grey. But then dark shapes started appearing, and I realised that it was just smoke drifting across. The doctor was making adjustments to the console, muttering to himself in that half-amused, totally absorbed way he had whenever we arrived somewhere new. Stephen and I always had to take a back seat while this ritual went on. Stephen was still a bit bemused by how the TARDIS shifted between times and other worlds. He'd only joined us recently when we rescued him from a horrible jungly planet where he'd been locked up by a group of over-bureaucratic service robots. And then there was that trouble with the monk. I always liked Stephen. He was a bit like a big brother. And we were both space travellers before we even met the doctor, so that gave us a sort of bond. And because I was smaller than him, it meant I could boss him about and get away with it. Anyway, the doctor finally announced that we'd need winter clothes and produced a set of thick coats and musty fur hats that he said were Russian. If that was the case, Stephen and I decided, Russia must smell absolutely disgusting. The doctor tutted and said it was just mothballs, whatever they are, and then he opened the doors and out we went. It was cold, absolutely freezing, and the ground was all icy and strewn with ashes to stop people falling over. The TARDIS was parked beside some stone steps, and there were crowds milling all around. So many people. Most of them dirty and wrapped in ragged clothes. Well, you couldn't call it wearing. But they were mixing with really smartly dressed, gentle folk who just seemed to ignore them altogether. The doctor was getting all excited. "This is 19th century Earth," he announced. "We're in Regency London during the Napoleonic Wars." He pointed to the huge dome of St. Paul's Cathedral. "I can remember seeing it in my own time, far in the future, still standing, after 4 world wars by then, and an alien invasion. But here, there were lots of low houses clustered round it, with a forest of smoking chimneys. And it was then that we realised. The ground wasn't ground at all. We were standing on the River Thames, actually on the river, frozen right across from bank to bank. It wasn't all flat like a skating rink, but lumpy, with mounds of ice jutting up all higgledy-piggledy. The doctor guessed someone upriver had cut the ice and it had travelled down in huge flows and got all snarled and scrunched up when it reached the London bridges. And this was a frost fair. The last one ever, he said. He always was a bit of a know-all. But it was fun, like a big outdoor party with stalls and games and exhibits all lined out like a street on the frozen river and called the City Road.
It's cold.
Oh, there you are. Good afternoon.
It's cold down here. And getting colder.
Not half as cold as it was on the Thames.
Too cold to remember.
Oh, stop complaining. I know it's cold down here under the temple, but I only topped up the oil in your lamp yesterday, and you can't need a new taper yet.
The oil turns to sludge in the cold.
Do I go on with this or not? Right. So, we were doing the rounds of the stalls. There were dancing booths and merry-go-rounds. And I just persuaded Stephen to go for a donkey ride when the doctor tugged at my sleeve. "Vicky, look, look." And he pointed to a poster that announced the Dagenham Dragon, witness an appearance of the fire-breathing brute. Well, you know what the doctor's like. You don't argue. So he dragged us through the crowd, getting all excited. And of course it wasn't what he expected at all. It was a circus fire-eater with a shiny bald head, dressed like a boxer, blowing flames out high over the crowd. It was pretty impressive. But the doctor started complaining. "Call this a dragon? No, I don't think so. I once saw a real dragon the size of London Bridge, and it would have thawed out the whole river just by sneezing."
"Signori, e bella signorina."
Suddenly, the strangest gentleman was forcing himself on us.
"Allow me to present myself. I am Hippolytus Valzacchi, purveyor of news and details, at your service."
He was all powder and sing-song affectation, and a cane idled between his fingers.
"Who's this?" muttered the doctor. "No, no, not today, thank you, good fellow."
"Signore, I perceive that you are but newly arrived in this city of delights, and I offer you my invaluable services as a guide."
"He thinks we can't look after ourselves," agreed Stephen. "Sorry, we're not interested."
"But there are so many doors closed to strangers. I, Valzacchi, am the key to open up 1,000 mysteries and delicious intrigues, whatever your taste."
"I knew it," the doctor said. "He's a gossip and a scandalmonger, and we'll have nothing to do with him. So be off with you." "That's right," added Stephen, looming over the nasty little man. "Leave us alone."
The next thing we knew, a sword had flashed out of Valzacchi's cane and was pointing at Stephen's throat. Stephen held his ground, and for a moment I thought there'd be a fight.
"That's enough, Valzacchi," said another voice, and a gloved hand grasped the blade and pushed it away. "Your sordid wares belong in the flash houses, not here in the presence of ladies. Away with you."
The Italian gave a sneer and bowed to the tall gentleman, very distinguished, who had rescued us.
"Good day and buongiorno, Sir Joseph, and to my Lady Georgiana."
He bowed low to a handsome young woman wrapped in an orange cape and sauntered away as if nothing had happened. The gentleman apologised profusely to us and introduced himself as our servant Sir Joseph Mallard with his wife, Lady Georgiana. They were most concerned that I was not distressed by this scoundrel.
Me?
And insisted on accompanying us round the rest of the fair. Lady Georgiana took my arm, and we were soon like old friends. Sir Joseph, it turned out, was deputy warden of the Royal Mint, and quite a few years older than she was, so Georgiana was glad of my company. They bought us hot spicy gingerbread, and we played skittles on the ice. Stephen beat both Sir Joseph and the doctor, who blamed his terrible aim first on the ball, then on the skittles, and then on the bitter cold. Georgiana and I could hardly stop giggling. Sir Joseph offered to buy us slices of so-called Lapland mutton, which was really just a roasted sheep, but it was a shilling a slice, and the crowd were being charged sixpence just to watch and get near the fire. Right at the end of the city road was a tent described as a collection of curiosities, the strange, the unexplained. There was quite a crowd, but it felt much colder inside than it did out. The proprietor, a drunken sea captain called McClavity, had set out a show of items collected on his voyages to pay the mooring taxes while his ship was stuck in the ice.
"It'll be a load of fakery," said the doctor,
and he swept along the displays, criticising every item. He was rather enjoying himself. There was a platypus, put together from bits which had never seen the other side of the Channel, let alone Australia, and a mermaid, half a monkey sewn to half a fish and covered in seashells, which is just what it smelt like. Some people will believe anything. Then Captain McClavity called for hush so he could unveil his greatest treasure. He started on a bit of a warm-up, saying how he had acquired this rarest of objects in the Medina at Tunis.
Ah!
Yes, I thought that would get your attention. Things go in circles, don't they? So, this great prize had belonged to a grubby old woman who kept it hidden at the back of her shop, and all she wanted for it was just one kiss. Obviously, she couldn't wait to be rid of it. I know how she felt. And once the captain had got the object, he set sail for England. But immediately, barely out of harbour, the weather turned cold with snow and ice, and it followed his ship all the voyage home to London. Georgiana and I could see the doctor right at the front, all bristling and ready to pass judgment. And finally, the captain took a pair of tongs and lifted a cloth that was hard as a board with frost. The crowd gasped as a giant egg was revealed. The Phoenix's Egg of Old Araby, he called it. It was as big as a head, and everyone went quiet. They just stared. Even the doctor had nothing to say. There seemed to be a light inside the egg, flickering like a lamp, with tongues of blue-green flame. And the air seemed to get colder, drawing all the warmth out of the crowd. I couldn't look away from the flickering. The shell of the egg cracked open just a little bit, but there was an eye, cold and wicked, blinking out at me, and I couldn't look away. And the cold was numbing my thoughts, and I couldn't breathe, and the whole place turned on its head and went black. The next thing I knew was a violent smell that jerked me back awake. I was on the floor of the tent, and a lady was waving a little bottle under my nose. "It's all right, my dear," she was saying. "You passed out with the cold." She had a warm, friendly face, but her eyes could look right into you. I could see the doctor and Stephen staring down at me over her shoulder, but all I could think of was the egg. "Don't let it out," I kept saying. "It's after me. It knows where I am." "Hush, hush, child," said the doctor, and took my hand. He could be so gentle when he wanted to be. But I was already struggling up, feeling all dizzy. I had to stop the egg from bursting open. And then I saw it, still sitting in its place. The egg was whole again, and there were no cold flames whatever was inside had closed up the crack. When I told them what I'd seen, Stephen thought I was being silly.
Well, he was hardly a seasoned traveller like me or the doctor. Even so, the doctor certainly didn't seem so sure. He suggested we leave the tent and started thanking the lady with the smelling salts, whose name, it turned out, was Miss Austin. I saw him double-take at that and study her hard. "Forgive me," he said. "Not Jane Austin. My dear, I am delighted to make your acquaintance. I have read all your novels. They are most elegant and witty. I am sure they will meet with unparalleled success."
The poor lady seemed astonished. "Sir, I thank you for your kind felicitations. But how can this be? For the sake of modesty, my novels, of which there are only two, are published as the works of a lady."
Of course, my dear madam."
"Miss," she retorted.
"Quite so.
But these things rarely stay clandestine in the circles I frequent. Have no fear. Your secret is safe with me."
Stephen and I just shrugged at each other.
I looked for Lady Georgiana and saw her talking determinedly with her husband. "I must have it, sir," she insisted. "That egg, it must be mine. I will pay anything for it." Her look, which was wild, to say the least, never left the object. It was as much as poor Sir Joseph could do to hurry her away. And I noticed, with a shudder, that another figure slipped after them. It was that horrible man, Valzacchi. It was just then that the rumpus started outside. People were shouting and screaming. The fire under the roast sheep was hissing and spluttering as its flames turned green-blue and lost all their heat. And there were more screams from further along. A plume of icy fire spouted into the air, and the next moment the crowd parted, and the Dagenham Dragon himself, wreathed in a halo of blue flames, came lurching through. He stumbled towards poor Miss Austin, who, to our amazement, gave him a sharp hook to the jaw and knocked him flat. It's the sort of thing that Stephen does, not a middle-aged lady novelist. The dragon shuddered and shivered on the ground, and then lay still. His flames died. Miss Austin just stood there, massaging her gloved hand, looking completely bewildered. Fortunately, Stephen had the sense to hurry her back under cover, but that wasn't the end of it. A heavy shape lay stretched on the tent floor. It was Captain McClaverty, quite dead, with a glistening icicle sticking out of his chest, and beyond him, the place where the phoenix's egg had sat was empty. The murderer had stolen it. And at last, Jane Austen started to scream. The phoenix's egg was stolen, and it was getting colder by the minute. You could almost hear the frost jangling in the air over the river.
And I didn't like the look of the crowd either. I just knew something nasty was going to happen.
It wasn't funny.
You don't know what I'm laughing at.
I don't have to visit you, you know. The sun's really hot outside. Even the Medina Bazaar shut down at noon because it's so hot. I could be at home sunbathing on the terrace with servants bringing me lovely, cooling rosewater sherbet while you're stuck down here in the cold.
You asked my opinion.
I didn't say I'd take any notice.
I'm sorry. That was unkind. Do you want me to go on with this?
Do I have a choice?
So, by the time we'd quietened poor Miss Austin down, someone had fetched the beadle. That's a sort of policeman in a big white hat. In fact, she got over the shock really fast. "Velvet paws and steel claws," said the doctor, and seemed to be much amused. Meanwhile, the mood of the crowd was starting to turn ugly, and people were pointing at us because we were strangers. I think they thought we were French. And that was when the doctor decided we should leave.
Miss Austin was right behind us, trying to hide her face in her bonnet. "Over here, I have a hackney carriage waiting," she said conspiratorially. I don't think she ever stopped being full of surprises. Well, we weren't going to argue, so we hurried up the wharf steps onto the embankment, piled into a carriage, and were off before the poor old red-faced beadle had even reached the top. When Stephen let slip that we had no lodgings in London, Miss Austin insisted that we simply must stay at her brother's house in Covent Garden. She and the doctor were getting on like a house on fire. Excuse the expression. And since we were all invited to Sir Joseph's for dinner that evening, she decided she'd find us suitable clothes. She was someone else you didn't argue with. It should have all been frightfully jolly, but I just kept thinking of the poor Dagenham dragon and the eye I'd seen looking at me out of the egg. The thing that said...
I know where you are.
Shut up! That's not fair!
Still scared?
Of course not. I should have brought more than one cloak. That's all.
With the heat outside. Mind you don't catch cold.
You're staying here.
Oh.
No more arguments. Where was I?
Miss Austin.
Thank you. Miss Austin always stayed at her brother's house when she came to London to visit her publisher. But she'd been stuck there for a week because of the weather. Anyway, while the doctor and Stephen were sorting through gentlemen's apparel upstairs, Miss Austin and I took tea and a turn round the room. "I am amazed, my dear Vicky," she said. "Can you mean that you have not come to the city with a mind to find yourself a husband? Is not that the first ambition for any young lady?" "But ambition is so boring," I said. "I'm having far too much fun to care about that." For a moment I thought she was going to get all stern with me, but she didn't get stern at all. She cocked her fan at me and said, "I have it. Of course, you are already settled on Mr. Taylor, but he, the busy fellow, has yet to notice." Well, I couldn't believe it. I mean, Stephen was quite dishy, I suppose. It's just that he was more like an older brother. But you know me. I couldn't resist it, not then. So I started to list all his accomplishments, the card playing, the horse riding, how well he sang, and his prowess upon the harpsichord, and his skills at fisticuffs and skittles and piloting ships. Spaceships. Not that she'd have understood that. "What a paragon," said Miss Austin, obviously impressed. "Enough to set the hearts of all London's ladies aflutter." When the doctor and Stephen appeared, they were both in knee breeches and rather dapper jackets. Stephen did look reasonably dashing, in a brotherly way. And Miss Austin gave me a knowing look.
Quite the dandy," observed the doctor,
not entirely approvingly, although I noticed he hadn't skimped on the velvet himself. We all set off in a carriage for Sir Joseph's house in Devonshire Square. It was colder than ever, and the narrow streets were almost empty. I didn't like the city at all. We'd hired a boy with a torch to lead us, but it was still dark and threatening, and very smelly.
"Then just be grateful this is winter," said the doctor. "Just imagine it at the height of summer."
But I felt sorry for the horses and the torch boy. The cold just clamped round us, as if it was trying to suck the warmth out of everything. Which I suppose it was. As we arrived at Sir Joseph's tall townhouse, we heard voices raised. A man in the filthiest clothes stood on the doorstep, arguing with a whole troop of servants, led by Sir Joseph himself. His face, lit by the lamps inside, was black with soot.
"I want my boy back," he was shouting. "He's still up your chimneys. I ain't seen him since early morning."
"Mr. Huggett," said Sir Joseph, "if you treated your climbing boys better, they might not abscond with such regularity."
"Chances are he's frozen up there. It'll cost me a full shilling to buy myself a new prentice."
Sir Joseph saw us arriving, and rather than continue the row in front of guests, he instructed one of his servants to pay the man. That was all the sweep seemed to want. He hefted his brushes and turned away, tipping his cap to us with a surly grin.
As he swaggered away across the square, I saw the familiar shape of the gossipmonger Valzacchi loitering in the shadows, staring up at the house. and then another carriage passed and he was gone. It was all light and warmth inside, with a big log fire in the main room, which was a bit worrying if the missing boy was still up the chimney. "It is more than likely," said Sir Joseph, "that the urchin was away over the roofs and back home long before his master, ready to play the same trick another day." This was quite a gathering. Ladies in those high-waisted long dresses and gentlemen in Regency jackets or soldiers' uniforms. The talk ranged from the war with France to the latest scandal in the city, but mostly it was about the cold. And they all kept looking at us because we were a new source of amusement. The ladies peered over their fluttering fans at Stephen because Miss Austen had wasted no time putting word round about his many accomplishments. He was soon quite a hit with the ladies. I had a couple of admirers too, but neither of them were my type, too affected and la-di-da, not a bit heroic, and certainly not a patch on Troilus. So I had to spend a bit of time avoiding them. The doctor and Sir Joseph were deep in serious conversation, and I guessed they were discussing the whereabouts of the stolen egg. The doctor just told me to run along and try the trifles. Cheek! But Sir Joseph suggested I might perhaps speak to his wife, as she had hardly been herself since they left the Frost Fair. It took me a while to find Lady Georgiana. I'd assumed she'd be playing the hostess, but she was sitting quietly in a corner, away from the throng. She had wrapped herself in a fur-lined cape and was pale and shivering. "It's just a chill," she whispered. But when I suggested she should go and lie down, she shook her head wildly and seemed on the verge of panic. "Did you see it?" she exclaimed and took my arm. Her hands were like ice. "The egg! Did you not see?" "Perhaps," I said carefully. "There was an eye staring out at me, out of the crack in the shell. It was burning with icy flames, and it looked straight at me. I could feel it burning cold into my soul." "Lady Georgiana," I said, "I think I should tell Sir Joseph that you're not well." "What does he know?" she snapped. "He did not see, and neither did you. Otherwise you would know. That thing chose me, and I have to find it." She was on the verge of hysterics, and I decided I'd better fetch the doctor. At that moment there was a great roar of laughter from the gathering. I think Stephen had been prevailed upon to join in the dancing, which was terribly formal and complicated, and of course, just as I suspected, he couldn't dance for toffee. He was treading on ladies' slippered feet and turning the wrong way, bumping into people. He gave me a filthy look, as if it was my fault. I had just pushed through to the doctor when he rose with an, "Oh, really, dear boy," bowed low to Jane Austen and announced that he would be greatly honoured if she would join him in showing these clodhoppers how to perform a proper gavotte. Well, there was no stopping him. He was a pretty good dancer too, and so was Miss Austen, and they were soon drawing applause from the throng. I was trying to corner Sir Joseph when across the room I saw Georgiana in conversation with one of the servants. After a moment, she followed him out of the room. And she was suddenly smiling.
"Scared too? Were you scared?"
"Yes, of course I was scared. I didn't say it to Georgiana, but that eye had looked at me too. I knew it would be coming for me. It was out there in the night, searching the dark city."
"You're getting cold. Come and warm your hands by the lamp."
"Oh, no. That flame's for you. That's all you get. That's why I brought my cloak."
"Only one cloak, and the cold gnaws into your bones."
"I'm not listening. Sir Joseph had just taken..." "Sir Joseph had taken to the dance floor with another lady, and I had no chance of talking to him, so I slipped out of the room after Georgiana." The hall was empty, but I could hear voices coming from one of the side rooms. "My Lady Mallard, forgive me this unseemly intrusion. Signor Valzacchi, my husband would be most vexed if he discovered you in our house. My lady, it is not your husband that I have come to see.
Well, I didn't need to be an expert in Regency etiquette to know that this was going way out of line.
And what might your business be, sir?
She asked, and she sounded very knowing.
I have come into the possession of a certain object, a curiosity, as you might call it.
Do you have it? She burst out. This curio, is it here?
Not with me, my lady, not here. But I can take to it at St. Cuthbert's. It's waiting. It wants you to come. His voice was like ice. It made my skin go all shivery.
Georgiana gave a little gasp of excitement.
Now, she said, oh, sir, take me to it, for there is nothing so much that I desire.
That was it. I turned back towards the main room and clunked straight into Stephen, who'd sneaked up behind me.
I knew there'd be trouble, he said. Go and get Sir Joseph. And for once, I did as I was told. I just ran back to the main doors, threw them open and yelled.
The music juddered to a halt and everyone stared.
Vicky, what is the matter, child? Complained the doctor.
Outside, I yelled. Sir Joseph, come quickly.
By the time we were back in the hall, Stephen already had Signor Valzacchi firmly by the scruff of the collar and was marching him to the front door.
What is the meaning of this? Thundered Sir Joseph. How dare you enter my house, sir?
Valzacchi just smiled, but he had a cold fire in his eyes.
My lord, Sir Joseph, I am forever your servant, as is your bella signora.
Sir Joseph went so red I thought he'd explode.
Out! Out with him! He yelled.
The servants opened the door and Stephen lifted the Italian and threw him down the stairs. There was a collective sigh from the ladies and a lot of fluttering of fans. Georgiana gave Stephen a really wild look and ran back into the main drawing room. Ignoring the staring guests, she started gathering anything she could lay her hands on, cushions, a tablecloth, a small table, and threw them onto the fire.
I am so cold, she kept muttering. It is coming for us.
But when Sir Joseph tried to hold her back, she struggled and spat like a cat. The doctor and Stephen were trying to usher the staring guests out when there was a sudden rumble inside the chimney wall.
Keep back, shouted the doctor, and a huge plume of soot burst out of the fireplace.
The ladies squealed, two actually fainted, as a small black object tumbled down over the flames and scrambled across the floor. It was the sweep's missing boy, and a miracle he wasn't burned. But then, the fire was really sickly and wasn't giving much heat at all. In all the chaos, it was Georgiana who slipped off her cloak and wrapped it round the shivering boy. He stared up at her with huge, terrified eyes.
It's here, isn't it? She whispered so gently. Have you seen it? The frost fire.
And my blood went like ice. The poor boy gulped and nodded.
It's on the rooftops. It's the cold climbing down the chimneys.
And it had turned bitter in the room. The guests, all nervy glances, started to hurry away. The candles guttered out. In the hearth, the embers hissed and flickered with green. Around the lip of the fireplace crept fingers of cold blue-green flame. They squirmed like serpents, stretching to seek out any warmth.
Out! Out! Yelled the doctor, and started pushing us towards the doors.
But Georgiana pulled free. She walked across the empty dance floor towards the fireplace.
No!
Shouted Sir Joseph.
But the frosty flames reached towards his wife, wrapped round her, and with a terrible whoosh, they swept her away, up the chimney.
Thank you. I thought they were coming for me. I felt so ashamed, so scared, but I was glad when the flames took Georgiana.
Are you weeping again? You're always weeping.
It brings it all back. Sorry.
The phoenix or the egg?
What?
Which comes first?
I don't want to know.
Simple enough. Each comes before the other. The cycle is endless. Like your weeping. It all leads round to the blazing moment. The flames take what they need.
You're jumping ahead. You're not even listening. I thought I was safe.
Safe until you were needed. You have your own moments too.
Not yet.
This is all your story. What about me?
Write your own. But you can't, can you? So you'll just have to put up with my version.
This is cold, cruel torment.
Too bad.
Heat. That's what it needs, said the doctor. This so-called frost fire gathers heat from everything, both animate and inanimate, and it puts us all in the gravest danger.
But my wife, said Sir Joseph, is she still alive? Where might she be?
The doctor shook his head. I don't know, sir. This is a terrible business. Terrible.
I think I might know, I piped up. Lady Georgiana was talking to that horrid Valzacchi man, and he was trying to make her leave with him. It was as if he had some power over her.
Or something had power over him, suggested the doctor.
He said he'd procured something for her, I added.
The stolen egg, exclaimed the doctor, taking all the credit as usual. Wasn't she fascinated with the object? Sir Joseph nodded.
That is true, sir. She talked of nothing else since we left the fair.
Yes, yes, said the doctor. And since we disturbed that objectionable fellow, the flames came for her instead. I'm sure the two are connected. Yes, we must find Valzacchi.
What a pity you saw fit to throw him out, Stephen.
Sorry to be inconvenient, Stephen began, but the doctor was already off on a busy train of thoughts. Now, where could we possibly find the scoundrel? What are his normal haunts?
Easy enough, said Sir Joseph. He can usually be found loitering around the tables of the Cocoa Tree Club. They will admit anyone these days, it seems.
Ah, yes, yes, disapproved the doctor. So you are a member too, sir?
For my sins, nodded Sir Joseph.
Splendid. Then we must repair there immediately. Have no fear, sir. We shall find your wife. Stephen and I shall see to that.
And me, I said.
Now look, Vicky, said Stephen. I've seen these old-style clubs in historical drama doc romances. They're not the sort of place for a girl.
Girl!
I exploded and thwacked him on the arm. Well, you can imagine. Now, now, scolded the doctor. Stephen's right. Not at all suitable. My dear Miss Austin, would you mind taking this young lady under your wing until we return? But you'd better watch her. She can be quite a handful.
Cheek! I was lost for words.
Now you mind you behave yourself, he said, wagging a finger. And off they went to the cocoa tree. Just like that.
Dear Vicky, said Miss Austin with a smile, those clubs are the particular domain of gentlemen. Somewhere they imagine they are safe from us. No lady crosses such a threshold.
But I'm not a lady, I protested.
You just declared that you were not a girl either, she said. That leaves us not a lot to choose from. Now, would it not be better if we just retired back to my brother's house? Today has been rather exciting, and I shall certainly feel a lot safer there. I looked at the elegant clock on the mantel. But it's only 9:20, I said. And it had been 9:20 for an awfully long time. We tapped at the clock, and it was icy to the touch. Its works were frozen solid. It felt as if the warmth and life were being sucked out of the whole city. Even time was freezing over.
Poor Lady Georgiana, said Miss Austin, pulling on her fur-lined gloves. Where can she be? And she asked a servant to fetch a carriage.
Hang on, I said. Valzacchi was taking Georgiana somewhere. It sounded like a church, St.
something or others, but I couldn't remember which one. St. Cedric's, St. Clement's, I was sure it began with a C. "Please, miss, St. Cuthbert's." It was Jem Huggett, the little sweep, with a chicken drumstick that he'd stolen from the table in his sooty hand. "St. Cuthbert's on the wharf. That's the nearest church to here." I exchanged one glance with Miss Austin. That's all it took. "St. Cuthbert's," she said. "Perhaps we should dare to go and look. At least the gentlemen are safe in their club." I didn't have to say a word, which made a change. Miss Austin was very determined. Even the servants, who clearly were anxious, didn't dare argue. But there wasn't a carriage to be had. Everything was shuttered and frozen, and only young Jem, who it turned out was the sweep's own son, so much for the little lost boy scam, was ready to help. "I can show you, miss. You'll be needing a torch, boy." He struggled to light a flaming brand, but the flames were pale and sickly. Even so, we were soon off on our journey through the ice-laden streets. Not that we needed Jem, because the lights in the sky were enough to see by. There were ripples of blue-green flame furling back and forth over the rooftops like an aurora, and the air crackled with frost. Jem led us along streets and alleys, calling out names as we went. Fish Lane, Hoggett Street, and Tanner's Passage. If Miss Austin were having second thoughts, she didn't say anything. Me neither. It was just understood that we had no idea where Jem was leading us. Poor people with no apparent home were huddled together in doorways. We passed a cart horse, frozen where it stood between its shafts. Jem spoke to one man, but he seemed scared to see us.
"You shouldn't be out here," he said. "Ain't you seen her? I heard she stalks the streets tonight. The dark spectre of winter herself."
But we carried on, neither of us wanting to be the first to admit defeat. There was a pale glow of fire ahead, and when we rounded the corner, we saw a bonfire with groups of people trying to warm themselves. "Not far now," said Jem. But we needed a moment to stand and take in what heat we could. We'd hardly been there a minute when the bonfire started flickering with cold green. So did Jem's torch. We heard the slow tramp of feet, and I quickly pulled Miss Austin and Jem down an alley, under cover. The crowd fell back as two haggard men, their coats thick with frost, hefted a shuttered sedan chair up to the fire. Its door opened, and a hooded figure emerged. Instantly, a chill washed round us like a wave. The spectre's face was hidden as it reached an arm into the pale flames. The frost fire licked along its cloak until the figure was completely wreathed like a cold torch. People started to fall sideways, clunking, frozen to the cobbles. As the figure turned, Miss Austin squeezed my hand. "It is she," she whispered. It was Lady Georgiana, the flames playing on her face, all silvered and shimmering with ice. Just her look was enough to freeze us to the spot. Lady Georgiana was moving closer and closer, and all my life and thoughts were shivering out of me. Miss Austin clutched at me for support, but there was no escape. And then I saw Jem lift his burning torch. He threw it at the spectre for all he was worth. There was a burst of icy sparks. Georgiana faltered, and for a moment her power was gone. And we turned and ran.
"There is no escape."
"Who for?"
"My Lady Cressida."
"Vicky. My name is Vicky. I was Vicky long before Cressida ever existed."
"There is no escape."
"I'm still here, aren't I?"
"And so am I. What happens next? In the story?"
"Don't you remember?"
"I live it again with each telling. Perhaps next time it will change."
"You can't change things."
"The cycle never stops. one day.
That's enough. I've been down here far too long today. Look at that. My fingers are numb with cold. See? I'm going back up.
Vicky.
I have my own life, my husband and children, two more young heroes. Do you think the servants can be trusted to do dinner on their own?
Lady Cressida.
Well, maybe tomorrow, if I ever come back at all.
No! The story goes on.
The story.
How does it go on?
We ran for all we were worth. Jem led us, but we daren't look back for fear of what might be following. Above the houses, the fiery sky flared round the tall spire of St. Cuthbert's on the wharf. If we reached the church, I knew the stolen egg would be there, but I'd no idea what to do when we found it. The church itself was quiet, and its doors were frozen shut. I'm sorry, I said to Miss Austin, we should never have come here, we should have waited for the doctor. I was surprised how kindly she looked at me. My dear Vicky, after this my own quiet world in Hampshire will seem tedious indeed. I shall never speak of it after, for my family and dear friends will certainly never believe a word of it. So let me enjoy all this while I may. Enjoy it? I don't think even I'd thought of it like that, although I did love to travel with the doctor, and we certainly had our moments.
The story!
Yes. The doors were shut, but Jem produced a crowbar out of his jacket, don't ask, and set to work. But even as he heaved at the doors, a cold light flickered inside the windows, and the doors creaked open of their own accord. We stared into the gloom. Jim, go and find the doctor, I said. Please bring him here. And Miss Austin added, be careful on the streets. There's a sixpence for you when you fetch him back. As the boy ran off, I took Jane Austen's hand and we stepped across the threshold. I'll never forget that sight. The candles were nearly all out, but we could see dozens of shapes in the pews. Rows of people all kneeling, heads bowed to pray for deliverance. Not one moved. All of them were frozen stiff where they knelt. Somewhere above, a bell rang, and rang again. Surely every clock in London was frozen, yet the clock in the Tower of St. Cuthbert's was still alive.
The clock, she strikes two, and all is far from ill.
We turned and saw Valzacchi standing behind us. His face was crusted with frost, but his eyes burned like hot coals.
The thing you seek, it seeks you also.
His arms moved jerkily, like a puppet worked by another power, as he angled his sword at us, urging us onto a stone staircase that spiraled up into the tower.
Eccola!
He cried with a flourish as we reached the small room at the top. On a nest of frost sat the egg. A shadow curled and twisted inside its shell, lit by its own icy light. Behind it, the slowly turning innards of the church clock clunked inexorably round. Don't look, I said. Don't look. But Miss Austin could not help but stare. I believed I was a writer, she whispered. But my imagination could never conceive of such monstrosity. The shadow churned inside the egg as it focused on us and considered our fate.
No, no, do not fear it, crowed Valzacchi. Rejoice as I do. It wants to know about the world into which it will be born.
The steam of my breath twinkled with ice crystals even as I breathed it out, and I knew that this horrible, hateful thing must be smashed away forever.
You are wrong. Let it be reborn.
How many people died so it could live?
It is unborn and blameless, so cold and alone. Let it live.
I couldn't. I picked up an old candlestick and ran at the egg to smash it.
The cycle must go on.
I had no children then. How could I know?
Even as I raised the weapon, cold flames leapt up and I felt all the heat of anger and life drain from me.
It has to be born!
Miss Austin caught me as I fell. We huddled together, helpless, as the egg glowed and flickered with so many stolen lives. Then there were footsteps on the stairs, and I felt warm hands go round me.
Vicky, come away, child, said the doctor as he helped me up.
There was a cry of anger from Balzaki. He ran at us, but with one blow from Stephen, the frozen man's puppet body shattered like glass.
It is not over.
My wife, where is she? Said Sir Joseph. Will that happen to her too?
No sign of her here, said Stephen. The doctor was already turning his attention to the egg. Hardly another wild goose chase, though, unlike the cocoa tree. I'm sure this unpleasant object will furnish us with answers.
But I don't know what was said between them, the doctor and the egg. There were no voices, and my head was swimming.
He was cold, that old man. No fire in his heart.
How do you know that?
Memories flicker down to us. While there's still a spark, something will be remembered.
And sometimes memories play tricks. But I know the doctor was right.
Thanks to him, we are both homeless.
That was later, and I made that choice myself. To leave my friends, Stephen and the doctor, and make a new start. A new world rising from the ashes of Troy. I knew that was right for me. I had to be with Troilus. But then the TARDIS was gone, and cold reality kicked in. History may be an amazing place to visit, but it's so primitive. They don't think the same or understand. No one has ever felt so cut off. The Trojans all thought I was possessed or cursed and wanted to leave me on a rock in the middle of the sea. Only Troilus stood by me. That's why we stayed in Carthage, while Prince Aeneas went off somewhere heroic to found Rome or something. And although I gradually made a new life here, you were the only one who spoke to me. Even if your voice is in my head, not outside, you were the only one who remembered the doctor.
Who was he to deny the unborn chick its life?
He was right. The doctor knew that if the phoenix hatched out, it would absorb and devour all of the Earth's heat.
1,000 worlds have burned themselves cold for the great bird to live. The cycle will never be stopped.
That's what you think.
The doctor made his futile threats, taunting and goading the poor chick.
Who's telling this story?
You digressed. I was bored with waiting.
I remember the doctor standing over the egg, saying, "Come on then, hatch out now. Let's see you in all your blazing glory." There was a moment of silence as the shadow in the egg shifted uncomfortably, but nothing happened.
"Aha, you see, you can't," the doctor crowed. "There's not enough heat for you to feed on."
"We must destroy the thing," insisted Sir Joseph. "It's caused enough horror already."
The doctor shook his head.
"No, no. For all its excesses, it's a unique creature, a legend, and I will not be party to its extinction."
"Well, it can't stay here," said Stephen.
"Surely we can take it somewhere where it can't do any damage."
"Oh-ho, and what did you have in mind, Back to the Medina in Tunis, perhaps? Or the depths of a volcano? Or the heart of a star?"
"Maybe," said Stephen, getting all pushy, "because I need to know that I have a future I can be born into, and Vicky does too."
"A future?" said Miss Austin. "How can anyone who lives now be born in the future? Unless, oh heavens, unless they live their lives backwards." Everyone looked at the doctor, who hummed and hawed awkwardly.
There was a commotion on the stairs, and Jem Huggett hurtled in. "Sir, sir, she's coming, it's her!" But he was too late. The spectral shape of Lady Georgiana was standing right behind him.
"Stay back from her," called the doctor as she surveyed us all with burning eyes.
"What does she want?" was all I had the energy to whisper.
She advanced into the room, green flames flickering over her cloak, and scooped the egg up into her robe. Sir Joseph edged towards his wife. Georgiana, listen, my love, do you still know me? I durst not touch you for fear you'll shatter. Her hand caught at his wrist. He cried out as she turned and dragged him, like a toy, down the stairs. Stephen ran to grab at them, but there was a cold flash of light that sent us all reeling. And then Georgiana and Sir Joseph had gone. From the tower window we saw the sedan chair and its gruesome porters struggling off along the street with Sir Joseph in tow. "Why take Sir Joseph?" muttered the doctor. "For what possible ends?" "He is her husband," suggested Miss Austin. "When a marriage is true, then all things are shared equally." In all this horror, the doctor smiled fondly. "A charming notion, my dear, but ill-placed, I fear, in such circumstances." "I was using irony," she said sharply. "Surely it is that thing in the egg that makes the choices." "Exactly," the doctor agreed. "It's the egg, not Lady Georgiana, that decides. So why Sir Joseph? What do we know?" "He has good contacts," suggested Stephen. "He belongs to the cocoa tree." "Hardly, dear boy. What would the egg want with parties and gaming houses?"
"He works at the Royal Mint," I said, "whatever that is."
A huge grin of satisfaction spread across the doctor's face.
"That's it. My dear Vicky, you are a genius."
"Am I?" I said.
"The Mint is where they make all the coins of the realm. There'll be a furnace there for melting down all the metals."
"To which Sir Joseph must have direct access," added Stephen.
"Exactly," cried the doctor. "And it's ideal as a hatchery for the egg."
"I could have told you that," I thought. "I'm a genius." So all we needed to do was to get to the Royal Mint.
"Jem," we all shouted.
"The Mint," said the little urchin. "That'll cost you at least a shilling."
It was not over yet.
But not far off. It was getting light as we hurried through the city. The fire in the sky was gone, the air felt milder, and there was a hint of rain to come. As we reached the place called Tower Hill, we heard a terrible screech echoing across the houses. It was like something crying for food or raging against the prospect of being born. The gates of the huge Royal Mint building were hanging open, and the sedan chair was abandoned outside. Two soldiers lay unconscious by the gatehouse. Anyone else had either fled or was hiding. Across a paved quadrangle stood work buildings whose windows were etched with frost flowers and blazed with the green fire inside. The screech came again, angry and hungry too. There was a hot breeze as the creature inside sucked the life and heat from the world. Yet a fur of ice crystals was growing on the walls even as we watched. "Quiet," hissed the doctor against the chorus of chattering teeth. He scraped the rime off the window and we peered inside. At the heart of a long room sat a huge block furnace, its door opening on an ice blue-green hell. The two haggard porters were turning a wheel to work the bellows. On the floor, Sir Joseph knelt like a supplicant before the tall figure of Georgiana. She clutched the phoenix's egg to her. The shadow of the unborn creature inside coiled violently and gave another shriek of rage. Georgiana turned and looked straight at us. The doctor met her stare head on.
"Time we put a stop to this," he said.
And apparently impervious to the cold, he threw open the door and marched into the building. The rest of us could barely stand for the cold.
"More heat! It needs to be fed!"
There was another screech from the egg.
"Give me the egg, madam," called the doctor. "It does not belong on this world."
"The phoenix must live and blaze," Georgiana answered.
"Oh, quite so. But not here, not on this busy world." And the doctor walked slowly towards her.
"Suppose I find it another place to live, It's the only one of its kind, I know. So we must take proper care of it." He stretched out a hand.
But Georgiana recoiled, clutching the egg tightly. A tracery of cracks had started to spread across the shell.
A fiery new world close to a white-hot sun, where no living thing can be hurt. Yes, yes, I think so.
A world of loneliness, soon to be cold.
The doctor edged closer. It's the best I can offer. So what do you say? It's either that or extinction. With a look of rage, Georgiana turned, and with a final effort, she flung the egg into the heart of the furnace and sank, discarded, into Sir Joseph's cradling arms.
More heat! Work the bellows!
The egg shattered in the midst of the cold fire. Out of the shell crawled a spindly chick with feathers like white gold flames. It threw back its heavy head and screeched, spreading its wings and starting to grow.
The bellows, called the doctor, but the rest of us were succumbing to the cold. It was too much. The doctor stumbled towards the great wheel and tried to stop it, but the porters shoved him aside and sent him sprawling, and then Stephen made a run and they both turned to fight him away. The wheel turned by itself, unprotected, as the phoenix beat its fiery wings, flinging icy sparks that spilled out around us. "Jem," whispered Miss Austin, "hand me your crowbar." She hefted the heavy rod in her hands and stumbled to her feet. She ran at the wheel, past Georgiana and Sir Joseph, past the fallen doctor and the embattled Stephen.
Stop her!
And she jammed the crowbar into the teeth of the great wheel. The machinery crunched to a halt and the bellows juddered and ruptured. Immediately the fire started to die. With a scream, the phoenix came scrambling through the flames towards the opening, but Jem and I were there, pushing at the furnace door. And for a moment, I saw its little eye again, pleading for mercy. You showed no pity to others, I thought, and we slammed the door shut on that monstrous fledgling. There was a shower of sparks, and I fell back with a sudden pain. Something was burning into my eye. I couldn't see, but I heard the door bolts crunching into place and the phoenix beating in vain against the walls of the furnace. Slower and slower it got as the fire died, until it was cold and silent at last.
Not alone. Even one spark will remember.
Well, my dear, I can't see anything now, said the doctor afterwards. I'm sure it's gone. Probably just a cinder from the fire.
Just one remaining spark.
I didn't know you were there, still with me.
Enough to rekindle the fire.
Not until much later, when I'd left Troy, when the Doctor and the TARDIS were far away, and I was Lady Cressida. Not until one day when I was weeping alone, and I found you, still burning amongst my tears.
And you keep me trapped, here in an old oil lamp with a single flame to keep me warm.
Well, someone had to look after you. You were the only one I had to talk to. So you see, the story always ends the same. And this time it's written down. The final version.
Not this time. The circle will begin again. It never stopped.
It's so cold down here. I've stayed too long.
We're all cold. But I must have my life. You've denied me it too long.
What are you doing? No.
Give me new life.
Oh, my story. No, you can't burn it. Put it out.
Life at last. The cinder becomes the fire. The egg will grow again. A new life. A renewed life.
It doesn't last, you see. It soon dies.
The story. How does it end?
I remember that. By then, the great frost was thawing. It had started to rain. But this was 1814, so there were no decent umbrellas.
Sir Joseph carried Lady Georgiana home. Neither of them said a word, but she did smile, gently, as if all the coldness in her frozen heart was melting away. Miss Austen, who was as surprising as ever, found 2 whole shillings in her reticule for little Jem. She thanked us ever so politely, and said that if we were ever in Hampshire we should call in. Dinner at Chawton is always at 8. And then she left. Writers are like that. I think she had a deadline. We had a real struggle to reach the TARDIS, which was heading off down the Thames on an ice floe. The doctor had to hire the waterman to get her back. Thank goodness he had a fresh supply of ready money to pay them, although he refused to say where he'd got it. There. That's it, really. And now I'll have to pay the scribe to write it all again. But I'm glad you're here, Frosty. Both alone. We've both got someone to talk to. Someone who remembers. But I won't be here forever, you know. And who'll look after you then, eh? I'm sure you'll find a way. Carthage won't be Tunis for a long time yet. So you'll have time to grow again. Cinder to flame to egg. And then Captain McClaverty will find his bargain in the Medina. And off to London you'll go. Your cycle goes on, you see. I can't save the people you killed. Will kill. They're gone already. But there won't be any more. So, there we are. Fresh oil for you tomorrow. And I am so glad I've got someone to talk to. Oh,